My name is Stephanie, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Destina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and to your understanding. Jessica will read the preamble.
Hello, I'm Jessica, and I'm an alcoholic. AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Philip will read the steps.
Hi there, Philip Alcoholic. The 12 steps. Step one. Thank you. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only knowledge for his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12 reads, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs.
And Brian will read the traditions.
Hi, Brian, alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create special we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Russell.
I'm Russell. I'm an alcoholic. I have no idea what I'm going to say tonight, so get into it and let it rip. Some house cleaning details. Right? I'm still Russell. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 16th of the year 2000. My sponsor's name is Frank. My home group is the Atlantic Group, and I'm working steps 9, 10, 11, and 12. And so let me say it's a I'm really glad I'm sober today. It's something else, and it's I've been coming around for a couple of days. And when I first came in, right that morning when I came up, and that morning when I woke up, and when I surrendered after my last drink, all that all I wanted to do was not pick up a drink, right? And I didn't think it would ever be possible that I wouldn't pick up a drink. Yet, surrendering to the to the principles of this program, the higher power, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink for a couple of years, and That's beyond my wildest dreams. I did this program two different ways, right? Because this is my second time around. First time I got sober was, in the early 90s. But I did, they call it two-stepping. I did the first step and I guess kind of the 12-step. I showed up. I didn't really work the program. I didn't drink. Just went to meetings. And then after a while, and it's true what they say, Alcoholics Anonymous will give you this stuff that will take you away from the room. So, I had a kid and I went back to school and I was working and I'll do better, I swear. It just took me away from the rooms, and little by little, I stopped doing the little things. First thing I stopped doing was I kind of stopped praying, and then I stopped calling my sponsor, and I stopped hanging out with people in the rooms, and stopped going to meetings. After about a year or so, I picked up, and that was it. And it's real funny. I grew up out on the east end of Long Island, and, I picked up that first drink in the afternoon. It was an afternoon. It was a Saturday afternoon. I think it was on the beach. It was a beautiful day. And, and there were the coolers. There was the Coke and there was the Bex and, or whatever in the Bass. And I just picked it up and quaffed it down. And, I had no plans that weekend. I was going to go to work Monday morning, all that. By 2 a.m, I found myself at some party in Park Slope in Brooklyn. And, right away, it's literally, it's not like you picked up where you left off. The disease of alcoholism, at least in my case, was with me as if I had been drinking the whole time. And within a week, I was driving drunk and doing all the stuff that I did. And it was incredible. And, a couple of years down the road, people around me were getting really concerned with my drinking. They'd say, Russell, why can't you just stop? And I'd say, finally got to the point where I said, I don't know. I can't stop. Every morning I wake up hungover and I say, I'm not going to drink. I make those foxhole prayers. You hear about God, please, don't let me drink. I'm not making, I was living in a place in New Jersey where my rent was $250 a month and I couldn't make it. I'd bounce my rent check. By the time I came in, I had a car, it had a pretty good radio in it, but I had a car and I was in an inappropriate relationship and the whole bit. And it just, nothing was working, and I don't know what it was. The last day I drank wasn't any special day. It was Friday afternoon. I remember my son was coming back from vacation and his mother was separated, from his mother at the time. And I remember for 3 weeks, Russell, that Friday, you cannot drink. You absolutely, positively cannot have a drink. And there I am, I'm in crosstown traffic Friday afternoon and in the middle of, July 15th. And there it is, just traffic. And I'm sitting in traffic and there's that corner deli and there's the Bass Ale Triangle, right? Do we know the Bass Ale Triangle? I sure do. And, And there it is. It's that special triangle. The Alcoholics Anonymous also has a triangle. I don't. Anyway, that's an outside issue. But there it is. But next thing you know, I pull over and I run in and I get a six pack. And next thing you know, it's 3 a.m. And I completely blew off my son. I hadn't seen the kid for like 3 weeks or whatever. And I blew him off and went and tracked down some friends and went on a dry goods run, and that was it. It was off to the races, and finally they're like, "Russell, we're taking you home or dropping you off at three in the morning." And there it is. Another cute story about my first day. I told a friend of mine, here's what I did last night. I did X, Y, and Z, blah, blah, blah. And the lady's like, that my friend of mine who knows people in the program and has been around Alcoholics Anonymous, not as a member, but, she married someone in the rooms and all that. And she's like, you're crazy, Russell. You gotta go to Alcoholics Anonymous. By that point, I'd been completely beaten. I said, yeah, okay, whatever. And she's like, tell you what, I'm gonna hook you up with this guy and he's gonna take you to a meeting, Jeff. Jeff N. at this point didn't have a car. It was kind of rainy, and he's like, well, all right, there's this meeting Saturday night down at the church, which I kind of vaguely remember in West Hampton. He goes, all right, can you come and pick me up? And and come to find out that 12 steps, when you go 12 steps somebody, you're supposed to go get them and take them to a meeting. But I had to go and drive to this guy's house, so I get 12 stepped into a meeting. So I guess I was pretty desperate at the time. So, I wasn't the man on the bed. Maybe I picked up the man on the bed, but it wasn't me at that moment. But there it is. I was so desperate, I was willing to do anything. And that night, after the meeting, we go over to this sober house, and Jeff takes off to go fishing, and I get surrounded by all these guys, and finally, after a while, people get tired of talking to you, and they go wander off and what have you, and there was this one guy who was still standing there going, hey, how you doing? And it was Frank, and that's all Frank had to say was, hey, how you doing? And that was it, off to the races, because my whole life story and everything else, and, off to the beach at 3 a.m, and he's like, all right, we're going to go to 79th Street the next day, but, I'm going to drive in, and you're going to follow in, and give me a call on the way. In those days, it was still legal to talk on the cell phone in the car, and so I did. I remember, I didn't think I'd be able to drive from Queens to New York City without stopping off and drinking. I'm like, Frank, yeah, I'm not drinking. He's like, that's good, Russell. Now we're going to meet at the meeting. And at 7 o'clock the next morning, there I am, like, going to work. I'm like, Frank, I'm not drinking. And that's it. That's the nature of the program. Going ahead and working with others and trying to help out other people. I remember after about 90 days, I got really depressed. I felt really bad, really, really bad. And by the way, depression tends to be temporary. It goes away. Things in life change. It's how I go ahead and deal with life. And he started showing me the steps. He started giving me the tools to go ahead and live again. Because I didn't, I came in, I felt like I didn't have any living skills. Maybe I could do a load of laundry, but I couldn't balance a checkbook. I mean, by the time I got in, I was bankrupt in every way. I was so broke I couldn't pay attention. And I was at the end. And one day at a time, he's like, all right, we're going to go ahead and do your fourth step. And I'm like, well, I don't really have any resentments. I'm just a nice guy, I'm just a nice guy. And 120 pages later, I got my fourth step. And that's it. I remember coming up on 90 days and I'm like, wow, this is really, 90 days is something else. And by the time I hit 90 days, I thought that should have been a holiday. I just walked around. I said, yeah, I got 90 days. I can't believe it. The person who had 2 years, a year, or what have you, that was, again, beyond my imagination at that time. And little by little, Frank's showing me the steps and showing me how to go ahead and write the inventory, showing me how to be willing. I mean, for me, the toughest step, I think, to get was the second step. I came to believe something out there could restore me to sanity. And after so much thinking about it, I wound up that my program is actually quite simple. It's nothing grandiose. It's trying to live the program for me. That's been pretty hard. Trying to be of service. Try not to think about myself all the time. That's been the hard part, is putting the program in my life. But the program itself for me is really easy. I came to believe, well, if I'm looking around and I see all these people and they're smiling, they're productive, and they're having a great time with life, they're having a great time being sober, well, they're believing that something can help them stay sober, because that's why they're here. And for me, it was as simple as that. Well, if running the life the way I've been running it got me in this position, yet everybody else around me is sober and looking pretty good doing it, then maybe something out there can help me. And that's as simple as that is the second step. And once I had that down, then I could go ahead and apply that to the rest of my life. Well, gee, you know, maybe the way I'm running life isn't really working the way I'm doing it, and maybe I should go ahead and try the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the meantime, you know, as it turns out, showing up and being of service to other people is really a side of my life. I remember a couple of years ago, my company decided they didn't want me around anymore. So I go out to the street and I'm like, what can I do? So I could either feel really sorry for myself or I could go out and pick up the phone and help somebody. And sure enough, there's this older gentleman who I've been trying to help out with a computer for a while. So I pick up the phone, dial it, and it's Van. And I go over and I went over and showed him how, you know, helped him out with his computer for a couple hours. So instead of feeling sorry for myself, I just lost my job. I went around the corner and helped him out for a couple hours, and it totally got me out of myself, and it was great. So anyway, my time's up, and again, I'm really grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life. If you're new to the program, stick around, do what these people say. It really saved my life. So thank you very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Trish.
Hi, my name is Trish Lees, and I am an alcoholic. I am petrified to do this right now. I am so petrified to do this that I've been dodging this podium for over 3 years. About 2 or 3 months ago, Ron actually asked me to read the steps, and I got all dressed up, and I showed up with flip-flops on. He said, you know, you can't read the steps with flip-flops on. So from then after, I used to wear jeans and flip-flops every Tuesday, so I didn't have to come back up here. And that's not a joke. My sobriety date is June 16th, 05. Phew. You know, there's no reason for me to be nervous. I'm amongst, like, friends and family and safety and... Wow, okay. I just have to chill out. My sobriety day is June 16th, 05. My home group is the Atlantic Group, and my sponsor is Kelly. I am presently procrastinating on step 9, revisiting step 3. Let's see, about my past. I don't really like talking too much about the drunk logs, but I do remember when I was really young, I used to really like getting sick because my mom was a nurse and she used to give us cough medicine with codeine in it. And so I remember really enjoying getting the codeine. So I wasn't a normal child. Also, I come from an alcoholic background and my mom's an active alcoholic to this day, but I was verbally and physically abused by her. And unfortunately, I reminded her of herself, and being an alcoholic untreated, you lose touch of reality. So she didn't like me because she didn't really like herself. So I never really felt like I fit in. I never really felt comfortable with myself. I didn't really feel anything. You know, I learned how to suppress my feelings and really become a really good liar at a really young age. I mean, I remember one time when I came home from school. I was in eighth grade. And I opened the door, and my mom was on the floor, passed out with a broken bottle in her hand, and there was another woman next to her passed out with the other half of the bottle. And it was really, really scary. And then my dad called, and he asked me if we needed anything from the store and how was everything. And I said, oh, Dad, we need milk. You know, meanwhile, my mom's passed out on the floor, and I learned how to lie to protect myself from dealing with a lot of excess stuff that a 10-year-old, 12-year-old shouldn't have to deal with. So I promised myself I would never be like her, and of course, the story goes, I became exactly like she was. And I remember the first time I got drunk, I was 16 years old, and I was upstate New York, and I got really sick, and I ran away from the whole crew of kids I was hanging out with, and I threw up. And then I cleaned myself off, and I went back down and drank more, and that's not normal. I mean, usually a normal kid would just go home and pass out and go to sleep, but I went back for seconds. And so, you know, I just kept drinking and doing drugs and just kept going. And I was actually a functional alcoholic. I went to school. I got a really good job. And I don't know how I managed to work. I don't know how I actually functioned. And I used to constantly live in fear, shame, and guilt, actually. I hated myself. And it got to the point where I just really wanted to die. So come about, like, March of 2001, I was in my therapist's office, and I said, you know, I'm done. I just don't want to be here anymore. And he was like, well, you know, have you figured out how you're going to do it? I said, sure, I'm going to jump off the pier. And he goes, well, what about your dog? And I was like, my dog doesn't deserve to die. And I got really mad at him. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, either do I. But yet, I love my dog so much, I didn't want her to die. So I saw the light for a millisecond. And backtrack a little bit. When I was in college, I was on the way to the veterinarian. I had two box turtles and a little thing. And I saw a friend of mine who was a heroin addict. And he said, will you please come to an AA meeting with me? I said, okay. I ended up going to St. Mark's AA meeting, which was really scary, scary place. And there I was with two box turtles thinking, what am I doing in this place? You know, this isn't for me. I'm helping my friend out here. Meanwhile, you know, I was an alcoholic. I just didn't want to deal with the reality of it. So I went to an, back to 2001, March, I went to an outpatient, and I went four hours a day for 4 months. But they didn't teach me about AA. They taught me about me, how to look at myself and all that stuff, but I didn't really understand the concept of AA. So I was a dry drunk. So I stopped doing drugs, stopped drinking, but I didn't do anything else. I had no spirituality. I had no program, and I was miserable again. So come September 10th, 01, I got to the point of suicide again. And my therapist at the time said, you really have to put yourself into a St. Vincent's so you don't do anything stupid. And so the next day, which was September 11th, I was walking the dogs because I was supposed to go to St. Vincent. And that's when I saw the airplane go into the Twin Towers. And I was only a few blocks away. And the first thing I thought was, you are such a selfish person because you want to die. Meanwhile, all those people are, you know, dead. And we didn't know what was going on. So after that, I decided to really take care of myself, and I moved to Minnesota. You know, instead of going to AA, I moved to Minnesota, and I did a geographic, and I took a hostage, I played house, I almost got married, and then I came back. And in June of 04, I was in Minneapolis, I was losing my mind again. I call up Intergroup, and I'll always thank this guy. I don't know who he looks like, who he is, but I called up and I said, can I please find a meeting with cool, artistic young people? And he, you know, I said, I don't want any old people in there. And then he said, well, you know, go to Central Pacific. And I went to Central Pacific in Minneapolis. And then in August, I asked them, where could I find a meeting like this? And they sent me to the Atlantic Group, and that's how I got here. And my life totally changed. So I worked the program. I remember my first night, I sat all the way in the back, and there was two people in front of me talking and talking, and they were annoying me to death, and I wasn't paying attention to anything, and I was hopeless. I go to the literary table, and I say, I need a sponsor. I mean, I was out of my mind, and then he brought me Kelly. And then I started working with Kelly. And I stayed sober for 9.5 months, but unfortunately, I wasn't working from my heart, and I wasn't really giving it all. I didn't turn to real spirituality, so I went out. I was at a photo shoot, shooting a show, and I went over to the bar to get a Coke. I actually ordered a Coke, and all of a sudden, this Irish guy stood next to me, and I heard his accent, and I was like, can I have a Jameson? Out of nowhere, all of a sudden, I wanted Jameson. I mean, but it was that quick. That's how it happened. I didn't have a spiritual foundation. I wasn't talking to my sponsor. I wasn't talking to any of my sober friends. And all of a sudden, it's something smicked in me, and that was it. And I stayed out for 2.5 months. And then, basically, if I didn't come back, I knew I was either going to kill myself or die. And since then, my life has been amazing. And one of the things I did want to talk about tonight was choice. I did my fourth step with my sponsor. And one thing I did learn, too, when I went out, I was working the fourth step. And it scared me because I really got to know Trish. Meanwhile, my whole life, I was looking to find a best friend, to look for something. I was always searching. And meanwhile, I was searching for me. And in the fourth step, you really get to know who you are. And I remember being with Kelly, talking about my ex-boyfriend, saying how he hurt me, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not quoting her, but I think she said something like, boo-hoo. And then I said, what do you mean, boo-hoo? You broke my heart. And she goes, it was your choice. You could have left. And all of a sudden I said, oh, it was like this revelation of choice. And everything I do in my life is my choice, every single thing. And that led me into the victim thing. I was always putting myself into victim roles and saying, woe me, why, you know, why me? Meanwhile, I don't have to do anything I don't want to do. It's my choice. It's my choice to be standing here right now. And the fact that I didn't call someone up and say, you know, my dog died a half hour ago, it's amazing to me that I'm standing here. And I have dreams and aspirations now because of this program. And this is, my dreams are going to make me stand in front of people and speak to people. And I hate this because it gets me so scared, but it's not that bad, actually, once you get into it. I could do this again. Anyway. So I learned about choice with the fourth step. And I also learned, you know, I want to thank people today who meditated. I want to thank people who prayed. And I want to thank people who did service, because without those three things, I wouldn't be sober today. Because those three things really make me a better person. You know, I mean, I don't have any sponsees right now, but, you know, I would love to have sponsees, because I think when I give myself away and get out of my self-centered mind, then I, you know, I am a better person and I could really help people. So this program, I mean, I'm only 2.5 years sober and I think I have clarity right now, but it's kind of a joke because I know 5 years from now I'm going to look back at me now and laugh. You know, and as time goes on and I get to know myself more, it's just an amazing, amazing, you know, gift of getting to know who you are and really, really liking yourself, because I'm happy. And, you know, I think I was so addicted to pain that I didn't know what it was like to be happy. And when I started getting happy, I got scared. So if you're new and you start feeling comfortable, it's okay, because it just keeps getting better. I mean, I'm not saying life is amazing all the time, because then I'd be cuckoo, you know. But I mean, the reality is I'm happy, and that's the joy of this program. And I want to thank you for asking me to speak, and it's glad to, I'm good to be home. I traveled two and a half hours to get here, my boyfriend and I, and it's just amazing. Oh, and it's really amazing to be in a sober relationship, too. I mean, one time we were having a fight, and I actually called him a name, and I don't call him names. And the first time in 2.5 years, I did, and he turns around, and he goes, oh, yeah, well, you're a victim. I mean, that's only in AA. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
This meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see remain here. If you are speaking at another group and wish some of us to come for support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. And now, it's my great pleasure to introduce someone who has been a hugely positive influence in my life over my past nearly 20 years in the program. It's my uncle and my sponsor. I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Bill D.
Hi, I'm Bill D, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was cautioned before I come up here that if I didn't speak the truth, my nephew Frank and my wife Kay over there were going to raise their hand. But I got to tell you about the old Irish saying that you should never want a good story suffer from the want of a couple facts. See, so keeping that in mind, something to puzzle over maybe. I started out as a kid as a loner. By and large, I wanted to be self-sufficient and self-reliant. I didn't look to anybody for anything. I determined if I was going to make it in life, I was going to do it. It was me. I was going to do it. And that's the way it was. I remember I was thrown out of a Boy Scout meeting when I was just a kid in grade school, and I looked into this window and I could see all my friends in there. I could see this boat that was going to go into the Allegheny River that coming spring morning. Anything else in the world, I wanted to be on that boat. So I looked in there and I thought to myself, who needs them? I don't need them. But I need this guy. So, you know, it's nice to be looked after, believe it. I don't know where I got those foolish ideas when I was a young kid, but I had them. And I wanted to be tough. I wanted to be strong. And I kind of carried that attitude into high school, where I was a stone loser, misfit, wouldn't do anything anybody told me to do, and that bothered me. And I'm in these kind of conflicts and what's going on in my life, and why can't I do this, and why can't I do that, and why are things going wrong, and whatever. And it bothered me. The summer after I finished high school, I had my first drink. I'll never forget it. It was outside of a beer and wine shop. up on Lincoln Avenue in the city of Pittsburgh. And we had a quart of beer, and we passed it around. And almost from the first drinking episodes, I made amazing discovery. I discovered there were two Bill Dixons. And this new Bill Dixon that drank, it was nice. It was a release. Everybody was all right. I was all right. You were all right. I could get along. I could do what I had to do. I didn't have all that angst and quarrelsomeness and whatever. It just, so, you want everybody's drinking story? I'm Bill Dixon and I drank. Little by little, drinking became more important in my life than anything else. My brother and I worked at a bakery. We worked our way through school. I was born and raised in an Irish, Italian immigrant neighborhood. I didn't know anybody who was a lawyer or what a lawyer did or whatever, but I knew someday I was going to be a lawyer. I knew that in fourth grade. And I knew that because of the confidence that the Sisters of St. Joseph gave me. They told me if I ever paid attention, I could do whatever I wanted to do. I'm still having trouble paying attention. But I somehow managed to get through law school. But anyway, he and I, we worked 42 hours a week. Full-time day students. And on Friday night, we worked 12 hours. We worked 10 hours Thursday, worked 6 days a week. Friday night when we finished work at 2 o'clock in the morning, went to school all day and showed up at work at 2 and worked till 2 in the morning. He said to me, where are you going? I said, I'm going down to the Italian club. He said, why are you going down to the Italian club at 2:30 in the morning? And I thought to myself, why not go down to the Italian club at 2:30 in the morning? So he said, why don't you come home with me? And tomorrow, Saturday, is our only day off. We work 6 days a week. And Saturday, you can go to the Italian club and go wherever you want to go. Why don't you come home with me? I said, no, I got to go down to the Italian club. See, booze was making decisions for me long before I had anything to do with it. That was totally irrational to go to the Italian club at 2:30 in the morning. He said to me, there's something wrong with you. And I thought to myself, why would he say that? My brother and I were very close. We looked out for each other. We took care of each other. And I know he cared about me. And I had no idea what he meant when he said, there must be something wrong with you. So I managed to get through college. I found that if I paid attention, and at least in some courses, I could do as well as I wanted to do. But also now I'm noticing that I wanted to go to law school. I wanted to be a lawyer. And I wanted good grades. And I'm finding that I'm doing less than I'm capable of doing. That bothered me. Because I was a very competitive person. And I wanted to be on top. And I could have easily done very well in some courses. But I didn't, because I didn't do any work. Just enough work to get a B or C. I went to service, and one time we come back off a cruise, a Mediterranean cruise, and we were up at Jacksonville Beach, and I went in for a swim at about 10 o'clock at night. I took all my clothes off and stripped out of my shorts. Meanwhile, there's a tremendous storm brewing, and the surf is rolling. I mean, it's rolling. There's a storm. So, I always like to surf. I said, well, I'll just go in here for a little swim and see what happens. And I got out there and I surfed. And I tell you what, I was very happy to get back in after a while, because I was being bounced off the bottom of that Gulf of Ocean. Wasn't much fun. So when I come out, I was in right in the happy arms of the Beach Club Police Department. And that was the first time I was arrested. Next morning, they let me out. I was mortified. I absolutely was devastated by that being in jail experience. So the next day, that morning, I went down on the beach and I sat next to two women. And I told them I'd been in jail. I had to tell someone about it because I just was stunned by it. Terrible experience. And I told them. Then I said, I'm going to take a walk and I'll come back. And I left my stuff there. I come back and guess what? They were gone. That's the story. That was the story of my drinking life. People who were responsible and wanted to do something with their life didn't want to have anything to do with me. Because sooner or later, in a position of responsibility, I was going to let you down. I came out, went to law school. Somehow or other managed to get through law school. Managed to pass the bar exam somehow or other. And then I pick up this thing, I'm a binge drinker. I was always a saloon drinker. Now, saloon drinkers of my type, we go into saloon, and then we go into the after hours club, and then when the daylight came, we went back to saloon. We do that for a couple days, or I did it for a couple days. The thing about that made life difficult is I never knew when I was going to do that. I would stop in someplace Friday. Next thing I knew, it was Sunday afternoon. Well, you know, people can't live their life like that. Like, I had some success as a lawyer, and people wanted me to represent them. Guy called me up and say, I want you to represent me. When can we get together? I say, how about right now? The guy say, right now. I can't do it right now. How about next Wednesday? I said, well, I don't know about next Wednesday. I was trying to live a life, a normal kind of a life, as a goofy alcoholic, out of control alcoholic, and it was making me crazy. And I would show up and I say, why can't you show up? You don't have to be Clarence Darrow. Just show up. Just show up and do your thing. So, binge drinkers, saloon drinkers, we're all the same. We got in a fight, you go to jail. No women. Women are gone. I mean, no woman in her right mind ever was going to put up with two dates with me. I mean, just wasn't because of my unpredictability. And another thing that happens to guys who drank like I did, we all go into the hospital to die. I made it. I didn't die. I'm here. So you don't have to worry about that part of the story in case you're getting ahead of yourself. Anyway, I was vomiting blood, and I started to feel better. And for some reason or other, the bleeding spontaneously cured. And I was walking around in the hall, and I saw a man out there that I was attracted to. And this man was beaming in a way. There was something coming out of him that I didn't understand. And I always thought I was pretty slick and knew about people and knew what was going on. But what was going on in this guy, what was happening to him, I had no clue. So I went over to him and I said, what's going on? He said, well, he says, my wife just had an operation. I said, well, what happened? He said, they amputated her leg. And this guy was so happy and beaming that he could take his wife home and be with her. And I thought to myself, who needs a one-legged wife? See? Right after that thought, I had the idea, you know, there's something wrong with you. And there was something wrong with me, but I had no idea what it was. There was a piece missing in me. What was in that man, I didn't know what it was, and I had no clue. That piece was missing. And I didn't know what that piece was until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so self-obsessed and so self-centered that it was not possible for me to think about anybody else under any circumstances. It's like I was in front of a large window where I could see the world. And the only thing I could see was a reflection of myself. Everything came off me. I started Ride Alcoholics Anonymous in March 17, 1960. And things went from bad to worse. It didn't work. But I started to really have something really go crazy with me. I was starting to go nuts, I thought. And I was starting to, I had this terrible, terrible fear that I was going to lose my mind. This drinking was going to cause me to lose my mind. And all I wanted in life was my mind because everything else was being taken away from me. And I said, well, I don't have my mind, I don't have anything. And I thought my mind was going to get up and go over here, right over there. That was going to be my mind. And there was no way I was going to coax it back. And I was going to be mindless without a mind. I was terrified. So one day in November 1962, I returned to Alcoholics Anonymous, not expecting that this was going to work for me. You know, I was a pretty bright guy. I could figure things out. Why should I expect to go into a room with a bunch of strangers and have them help me with a problem that I didn't have? See, I was no alcoholic. And I knew if I continued to drink that alcohol was going to kill me. My drink was going to kill me. But I was no alcoholic. See, I was full of contradictions in my thinking. It didn't matter. That doesn't make any sense, does it, for anybody but another alcoholic? That makes perfect sense because I thought alcoholics were people who couldn't drink. I drank. I couldn't think of living in life and not drinking ever since my first drinking episodes. It was like thinking about, if I show you the palm of my hand, imagine the palm of my hand without any skin. The mind won't handle that. You can't do that. It's the same thing. I couldn't live in life without drinking. That's who I was and what I did. But I determined not to drink. So I was going to come around AA because I knew that if you didn't want to drink, you went to AA. So I went to AA and I went to this group. And there were six of us there. We all drank together. We were the Slippers group and we were all crazier than hell. We were a ragtag bunch of goofs, absolutely goofy. So one day, this guy came, Mike Kelly, who's not dead, and I admired Mike, and we were all standing outside. The meeting started at 9, it was 9:15, and the door wasn't open. So one of our guys, we had a very interesting bunch of the six of us. One was a burglar. And in minutes, he said, I get in here. And the door opened, we all went in. See? So I said to myself, that's not going to happen again. If I'm going to be a part of this group, I'm going to see that that door is open. So I got the key, and I made the donuts. I mean, I made the coffee, got the donuts, did all everything. And that's what I did. I continued to do it. And I did it with my cousin. Everybody pays a price coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody comes in free. They used to say, how big a price you want to pay, that's up to you. My cousin, who I dearly love, was a paraplegic. He fell off a roof when he was drinking and severed his spinal column. And he lived 20 years or so as a paraplegic. Horrible, terrible life, I thought. But anyway, we used to drink together. I never liked to drink alone. And he and I would go drinking together. I go to the Veterans Hospital and put him in a wheelchair, wheel him out to my soul beat up Cadillac I had, and we go off drinking for a couple of days. So I went to AA. Bob's going to go to AA. So Bob comes to AA with me. Bob was so happy to get out of that Veterans Hospital, I think he would have went anywhere. But anyway, he seemed to like AA, and we were going along doing pretty good, whatever. And they say, what happened to you? What happened to me was John McHugh. This guy, John McHugh, got my life. He said to me, you're going to make the retreat. Oh, yeah, I'm going to make the retreat. I wasn't going to make any retreat. See, so now I'm trying to be civilized. I'm not arguing with people. Tell them why. Don't bother me. Just say yes, and then don't do it. See, so I came around retreat time, and I say to my cousin Bob, Bob, you want to go to the retreat? He surprised me and said, yes. So because he wanted to go, I went, because he was my pal. And that was important. Whatever he wanted, I stuck with my pal. I always did that. It was a neighborhood kind of thing. So we go up to the retreat, and he wants to tell me something. I says, don't tell me. Go tell the priest. And he does. Surprises me. So because he did that, I did that. See, nobody gets ahead of me. So I went to see the priest because he did it, and I don't want him to get ahead of me. So I get in and I tell the priest that I'm no good now. Never have been and never will be. And I don't want to waste your time and mine. I'm tired of being disillusioned. This won't work for me. On and on and on for about 20 minutes. He very patiently listened and then with a great gusto threw his chair back and looked me straight dead in the eye and said to me, you got the worst case of self-pity I ever heard. And I thought to myself, here's a holy monk who wants to be a martyr. I did not like to be disagreed with or told things head on. It just made me crazy. And I was full of anger and rage. I just rage and anger, just wandered around totally. I don't know what I was. Anyway, I was wandering around. So one thing, when I come down off the monastery hill, I had two things that I didn't have going up there. I knew that God had forgiven me, and the way I was raised, that's important. And the second thing I had was a little hope. So I come down, I run into John McHugh. Now this guy McHugh, I always liked him, and I admired him. I admired what he had to say, and mostly I admired what he did. So I thought I'm going to get in his good graces, and I took a look at the literature. And I concluded that this is a spiritual program. The spirituality is in the third step. So I went to him and I said, John, I said, you know, I can't make the decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. He says, you're not ready for the third step. There we go again, see. Did I ask him what step I was ready for? See, what he didn't know and I knew, I wasn't interested in these steps because they weren't going to work for me. How did I know that? If it worked for you, it wasn't going to work for me. I was different than you were. So we stood there for a while and I said, what step? He didn't say anything. I said, second. He said, no. Then it came to me 19 years in school and I figured it out. This guy wants me to start on the first step. Can you imagine that? You know, he thought if I did what you did, that I would eventually feel good enough that I would never have to drink again on a day-at-a-time basis. That's what he thought. Now, there's arrogance. That shows a dismal lack of understanding of who I was and who he was. But I didn't give up. You know why? It says keep coming back. You know why they tell you that? So you can work with your sponsor. Try to get them to see the light. So then he said to me, if you wake up tomorrow, ask for help. He always was saying these little things that irritated me. If you wake up tomorrow, now why would anybody be irritated if they said to you, if you wake up tomorrow? That made me crazy. And not the fact that he said it, what bothered me, why was I so agitated by it? You know what that trickster was doing? He had more tricks than some guy at a Barnum Bailey circus. What he was trying to introduce me to was the concept of powerlessness. See? Because we're all going to die. Everybody in this room is going to die. That's one of the definitions of a human being. So I had to identify myself as a human being before I could become an alcoholic. See, when I wasn't a human being, I was a god. You know, being a god's a wonderful thing. You're always right. Know everything about everything. You're superior. It's just a wonderful place to be. The only thing wrong with it is that something was making me crazy and I didn't know what it was. So I start asking for help in the morning. And then he says, don't be an ingrate, give thanks. Now, he didn't ask me whether or not I believed I was going to get help. He didn't ask me that at all. And he didn't ask me to give thanks, thought I wouldn't be an ingrate. He just told me to do it. One of the things about my sponsor, he knew that he knew, and he knew that I didn't know. And that's the way it was, see, and that's the way he proceeded accordingly. And I tried to divert him from his ways, but no, he hung in with that. Now, he said to me, you know, Bill, nowhere in the literature does it say you have to be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. What it says, you have to be powerless over alcohol. Powerless over alcohol? That's another thing that made me nervous. It's so easy for me to admit I'm an alcoholic because that doesn't require anything. See, when he said powerless over alcohol, that means I'm without power. That means I gotta go outside of myself. That means I gotta trust somebody. I don't trust anybody. I trust me. And if I can't do it, it can't be done. If my superior intellect and iron will can't do it, it can't be done. Nobody can do it. So, he said, why don't you spend 1 year on the first half of the first step? He said, you're going to have problems with your ego. I had no idea what the hell that meant. But he did. So after I was sober a year, I thought to myself, I got a year of sobriety. And I felt better than I ever felt in my life. That first year of my sobriety, I think, was the happiest year of my life. Because so many new things were happening to me. I was coming alive. And I thought to myself, that desire to drink, that terrible obsession was gone. It was a fact in my existence gone before I was aware of it. Therefore, I knew it was a gift. I didn't know that that's what I was looking for, and little did I ever expect I was going to get it. So I determined that was the grace of God, and not Mr. Wonderful who did it. So then I got into the fourth and fifth step, and the fifth step, I had this lawyers like to write a lot of things, so I had this large list of pages of stuff, didn't mean anything, and I had kind of a one-sentence thing about my father. And I wasn't going to write that down, but I did anyway. That is why it's so important to read off the list. So when I read that to the list, my relationship with my father, I broke down in tears. I never cried in my life. You couldn't make me cry. You beat hell out of me, but you couldn't make me cry. And I broke down and I cracked up. I was cracked some way. And things were opening up some way. And I thought to myself, it's not what my father did to me, it's what I did to him. I never honored him. I never respected him. I was a lousy, rotten son. Everything he did according to his lights. He made sacrifices for me. And how did I reward him? By being disingenuous. Tricky. Bad. And no honor, no respect. I'm grateful that I got that insight. Because as I come to understand that idea of annoying people and being rebellious and whatever, I found out I wasn't rebellious or mad at you, I was mad at my father. And myself, primarily, for not being a respectful son that I should have been. And I got out of my AA program. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, from my opinion, is not self-taught. I had the best teacher there ever was. John McCune knew more about alcoholism and alcoholics than anybody ever knew before, after, since. I was privileged to have him as my sponsor. Let me tell you about some of the good things that's happened to me since I've been sober. Last month, I was sober 45 years. Yeah. I look out at all you young, beautiful people, and I think to myself, when you get as old as I am, then you'll be so 45 years old. So anyway, where was I? Yeah. I'm sober for 2.5 generations. I have 5 nephews and a great niece in AA. I've had a life. Our literature talks about being happy, joyous, and free. We know what happy is. And free, I am free to do the things that I'm supposed to do, not what I want to do. And because I've done those, I haven't accumulated a lot of guilts. I told my spiritual advisor one time I did this thing that was wrong, I felt guilty. He says, aren't you lucky you do? If you do what's wrong and you don't feel guilty, maybe you're a psychopath or sociopath or whatever. I don't know what you are. That's your problem. You figure that out. I don't know. So I met my responsibilities. I was there when my mother and father died. I buried 2 brothers and the sisters. I was there, and thank God for that. If I had been off drinking somewhere and I missed that, I think the guilt would have been so bad I'd have never gotten over them. The next thing is, what does joyous mean? Joyous means that I have to know that God's love. My spiritual advisor told me this. Joyous means I have to know that God loves me and I have to experience that love. Now I've returned to my church, and I experienced God's love in my church. But I tell you, I experience God's love every time I go to an AA meeting and I participate. We're a room full of miracles. I mean, there's my friend Clancy says you can't be too sick for AA. And listen to my lead, you can also think you can't be too stupid. You know, I just came and did it, and it worked. The other thing is, when Bob was dying, this lady put a sign up there that says goodbye. Is she leaving or what? Hey, Peggy, I didn't think I was that big of a disappointment. Look, I'm 45 years old. I'm going to take another 2 minutes. When Dr. Bob was dying, he said AA's 2 things, love and service. So that kind of caught my attention, love and service. That's an ID together, not love period, service period, but love and service are coupled together. Does that mean if I serve people, I have to love them? No, it doesn't mean that. Because when I was first working at Mahana Park Group with those bunch of posers and myself, I didn't love those guys. I didn't love anybody. The gift of being able to love came to me, from service, trust, surrender, and doing the things that you taught me to do. And as a result of that, I found a gift of love. That man who was in the hall that time that was anxious to have his wife come home to him, I'm like that man now. I know what it is to care about somebody without any thought of return. I owe that all to you. See, because if I didn't have that, if I didn't know how to love and be a part of this thing, I would know nothing. Doesn't matter how successful I would have been or how much money I would have made. I probably would have made a lot. But that doesn't matter. The important thing is that I know how to love and I know how to care. My wife is here. We're married since 1981. I'm not too good at arithmetic. That's because of you. If I had been in AA and learned what I had to learn here, I'd have never had that wife. I'd have never had all the good things in life that come to me. I got a way to go. I'm no longer standing outside looking in saying, who needs them? Who needs them? Me. I need you. Where did I ever get the idea that I didn't? I'm a weak, fallible human being. That's the definition of a human being. We're all weak and fallible. We need each other. And I thrive on that. Now, this lady, she's starting to really get... She said I was supposed to wink. I don't know what that is. But anyway, thank you very much for giving me the extra 2 minutes.